Our world is built with stories.
Sometimes these stories cause suffering by pulling us apart from ourselves and each other.
The Liturgist podcast helps people love more and suffer less by pulling apart the stories that pull us apart.
Hey, everybody. My name is Michael Gunger. In the last few years, the term cancel culture has swept through the internet and the collective consciousness and lexicon with surprising speed and, of course, divisiveness. I mean, even saying the words feel fraught. Some people blame all of the ills of our society on cancel culture. Others say that so-called cancel culture is not even a real thing, and that people's naming an aversion to what they perceive as cancel culture is really just another attempt at ignoring or silencing marginalized voices in order to maintain the status quo of patriarchal white supremacy. So what is it? Is cancel culture real? Is it a thing? Is what we call cancel culture inherently destructive? What does what we call cancel culture say about us as a society, as individuals? We're going to dive into all of that and more today on this mega episode of the Liturgist podcast. Calling it a mega episode because it consists of four different conversations. The first conversation that you'll be hearing was between Jamie Lee Finch and myself. And this conversation actually happened in the middle of a different podcast, a private weekly podcast that we post every week for the community, The Alien and the Sex Witch. And which, by the way, you can access that full conversation and dozens of other unreleased podcasts and meditations by joining the community at theliturgists.com. In the second conversation on today's mega episode, another great conversation, William Matthews and Hillary and I talked to Dr. Robin Espinoza, who is an amazing trans queer activist, Latinx scholar, ethicist, and theologian. Really enjoyed that conversation. And then in the third conversation, Dr. Hillary McBride and I speak with Chloe Valdery, who's this amazing writer. She's been published in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Atlantic Magazine. Really enjoyed that conversation. And then if this is a meal, we'll round out our fine meal with a lovely philosophical dessert and a beautiful conversation that I had with our community's beloved Peter Rollins. And this episode, with all of these conversations, it's going to include a lot of perspectives from different places, a lot of different experiences. And as always, just to let you know, the Liturgists as a community doesn't hold to one of these views officially. The Liturgists is sort of the messiness of all of it coming together. We're here for the dance of all of it, the messiness, the vulnerability, the dissonance. So I do hope that you'll listen to each of these conversations with an open mind and an open heart. And I think that if you do, all of us will have something to learn about ourselves, to learn about how we engage with each other. And I think it will leave us all better off for it. I know I've gleaned a lot in these conversations that have happened, and I think you will too. So welcome to the Liturgist Podcast, everybody. People talk about cancel culture. Let's talk about it.
And whatever it means.
Whatever.
To whoever's talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what does it mean to you?
I mean, first of all, I think a thing that bothers me is a lot of people don't know the legitimate and helpful roots of where it came from, which was Black women who were trying to protect themselves and correctly so advocate for themselves and hold people in positions of power who are abusing that power accountable. And then like most things, other people decided to get a hold of it. A lot of white people decided to get a hold of it and erased the legitimate roots of where it came from. And so now it's become this thing that op-eds and all these things are written about how cancel culture is bad. And while I don't disagree with like cancel culture is bad, like the thing, I also don't agree with it because I think the thing that maybe is more accurate to say that I think is deeply unhelpful is reducing any person to a product, which is just what we do through social media for the most part, reducing a person to a product and assuming that because you consume that product, you are in a position of being able to make demands upon that product about how it presents itself, how it is marketed, how it is consumed. And if the demands that you have made on that your idea of that product aren't met, you then now get to draw this assumption that that is a bad person and they should and deserve to lose the things that they have and have done that are outside of your idea of how that product should be presented.
Wow.
So that's not the same thing as holding powerful people accountable. But it's become this thing that we've equated cancel culture as this thing that, well, I just get to hold anyone I'm in my perception of proximity to on the internet accountable. You don't. That's not how accountability works. But we're in this mindset that that's how accountability works because people there. I have 14,000 followers on Instagram. I share really vulnerable things. I've written a book about deep aspects of my personal life. I have recorded a number of podcasts sharing deep aspects of my personal life that people have listened to real up close to their ears. So they have a felt sense of intimacy with me. 14,000 people on that platform think that they have relational proximity to me. Mm-hmm. They don't. So when they're talking about holding me accountable, they're not even wrong in their idea of what they're allowed to do necessarily because they think they have proximity to me relationally that they don't because they've consumed me as a product. They don't actually know me as a person. Ooh. And now they're making demands on that product to be presented in a specific way. So when I learn in public or am a person in various different ways, all of a sudden my professional, like what I do for a living, my ability to pay my bills gets put into question if enough people have decided that the product, the way I'm presenting the product in that given moment is unacceptable to them. That again is not the same thing as what cancel culture canceling originated as, which was to protect vulnerable individuals from powerful people who were abusing their privilege. They're two incredibly different things, but we've made them the same thing largely. And most people are moving and behaving in online spaces, not knowing how to do the difference. Because I don't think social media is a place where you can functionally actually hold people accountable, which again is why I'm going to law school. Because I'm like, I believe in accountability. And I think the more we keep trying to get accountability to happen in online spaces, the more we keep hurting people. And the more we keep like, we're really trying our best, and I don't think we're doing it well. And so I think holding powerful individuals accountable who have been abusing their power and abusing their privilege, as far as I know at this point right now, and I'm willing to be wrong and proven wrong later and change my mind later. But right now I'm like, that looks like taking them to court. So it's a complicated thing to talk about because everybody knows the term. Everybody has a different idea of what the term means. And it mm-hmm. is helpful sometimes to cancel an individual, to take away their power that they've been abusing. And it is also not helpful to equate people with products. And if someone is not presenting the product in the way that you've decided you would most prefer, that means that they deserve to have things taken from them.
Can you talk more about what the difference is in your perspective between those two different ways of using the internet to call out bad behavior? What are some other distinguishing aspects of what you might consider an unhealthy, consumeristic based sort of cancel culture or a more healthy and justified people speaking their minds about something that is destructive?
I mean, that's an even better question because that's a harder question. Because I can tell you what bothers me about it, and I can tell you what has hurt me, and I can tell you what has hurt other people that I know and love. And I can also tell you when it's done something, when like a movement of people speaking out online about someone in a position of power who's abusing the power has created positive consequences. It's easier to point to like, here's what it doesn't look like than pointing mm-hmm. to this is how it should be. And this is where I go back to the whole, like, I don't think social media is ever going to be the thing that we really, really want it to be. I really don't. Like, I think we keep, because I just don't. So the thing, one of the things I will say about when I think we've all seen like this go well, where people who are in vulnerable positions speak up together about people in positions of power who've been abusing that power, when that goes well is usually when a journalist gets a hold of it and fact checks and deeply fact checks and then writes something alongside a number of people, elevates those voices, and there is a level of journalistic integrity and also just like it puts a megaphone on it, and it also like funnels it to where it's not just like a bunch of, and it's helpful because it's not just like a bunch of people saying something on Twitter or Instagram. It's one person who collects all of that and then puts it on a platform. And so that is a really, I think when marginalized voices combined with journalistic integrity, when those two things get thrown together, you see really powerful, positive consequences of that combination. So I can tell you that's, I think what so far I've seen when it like works really well. And then when I think, that might be the only time I've seen it work well. I don't think that I've seen examples of, because I mean, I just, it would take so long to tell you like all the stuff I know. Like there's even people that like, years ago, one person that kind of the typical way this stuff goes on Twitter, like someone is gaining in popularity because of an account and then someone digs up dirt on them and claims to be like protecting them because they're not who they seem to be. This person, you know, loses a lot, gets fired, all this stuff, has to make their account private, insulates. And then I had someone, and I'm being vague for a reason, but I had the person who it was being claimed was the person abused in that situation reach out to me privately and say, I don't know who to talk to or how to share this, but like the way this whole thing is, the wheels on this are turning, this is not what happened. I was not abused. This didn't occur. And I don't know what to do or how to stop this. And ultimately I told this person, I was like, thanks for sharing this with me. I don't know what to do or how to stop this either, to be honest with you, because it's already just people. And this is why my whole thing with social media is like, social media is designed for conflict because conflict creates engagement. And so when someone turns a person into a product and says blanket statement, here's this whole, this person is exclusively bad now. Like I was watching when this happened to me one of the times, like when you go down the rabbit hole, it's wild because I was watching like valid criticisms of me and some of the things that I had said and some of the ways in which my perspective was more limited than it should have been, turn like go all the, like in a matter of 48 hours, like go all the way down into someone accusing me of plagiarizing my thesis. And I saw this person lob that criticism or lob that accusation out on Twitter, and like a handful of people just read that tweet and go, oh my God, I had no idea. That's horrible of her.
Right.
That's it. That's all it took. And I'm like, what the fuck do you do in a situation like that? Like, and then the other times when this has happened to me or when this person was reaching out to me and was like, I don't know what to do because what's being said like didn't happen. But this person felt like they were being objectified because the accusation was that as a powerful man abusing, you know, a woman. And she's like, I feel like I'm being infantilized, like as if I'm not a grown woman who made my own choices and I don't know who to talk to about this. So again, it's just the ways in which we see things be mischaracterized. And then when you're watching yourself be mischaracterized, even if you try and like tiptoe in the direction of like, can I clarify this? Or like, can I explain this? Or can I maybe like stand up for myself in this situation? You just get more shit lobbed at you because like, well, now you're doubling down. You're being defensive. And I'm like, okay, I don't know what to, like, I don't know what to do. And so we're like doing this at each other because we think we've seen it work in towards people in positions of power. So we're like, and also the perception of power is a whole thing. And this is something I probably talked about, Andre Henry and I've talked about this before, like We realized this in conversation once where we both just keep coming back to it. The amount of people who think we're rich.
Yeah.
I'm like, where did you get that idea from? Right. Like people who are mad at him for selling merch because they're like, oh, you're exploiting people because you're just making money to make money because you're rich. And he's like, why? Because I have thousands of followers on the internet. You know, that's not money. Right?
Yeah.
Like, so people even perceive people to be in positions of power they're not actually in because social media follower count is a currency that isn't real. But we think that that's the same thing as being Harvey Weinstein. Mm-hmm. Is like having 50,000 followers is the same thing as being, you know, someone in his position of power. And so again, it's like, we got to talk about power dynamics, and how we're not doing what we think we're doing most of the time when we think we're doing this. So it just, I'm not sure how it works. I'm not sure how we make it better, because I don't know if it can be made well. I have no idea. Don't know. That's why I'm like, all right, I just want to find a career that I can just not be on the internet anymore, because I don't want to do it. It's also really bad for my brain, because I have ADHD and I have rejection sensitivity dysphoria. So I go into limbic shutdown. So it's a product of my disorganized attachment and my ADHD, which kind of play together. So the only thing I can tell you is when I experience something that is actual rejection or perceived rejection, this is not an exaggeration. What happens in my brain is that it feels like I'm dying. Actually dying. Limbic shutdown in my brain, because I, in the first 10 months of my life, via disorganized attachment and also immediate illness upon me like arriving in this body, I was dying. My physical body was dying, and I wasn't getting my needs met because I couldn't get my needs met. And the way in which that ended up manifesting in how I live and move through the world now is through something called rejection sensitivity dysphoria. So me trying to be an internet person and people turning me into a product and not a person, someone with my brain just can't, I can't be on the internet this much.
Yeah.
So I just think we're doing a lot of things to
people.
It'd be
one thing if you were just like posting pictures of kittens.
Which maybe we should just start doing.
You'd still get hate about.
You might. Yeah, actually you probably would. You know, people are like, why are you only post cats? I like dogs. And you're like, well, go follow a dog account. I just want to be here for cats. Because, I mean, you're right. It's like, even if people aren't mad about what you're doing, they might get mad about what you're not doing. And again, this is the whole, we've turned people into products. And like, we are doing this to each other, but only because a really exploitive, traumatizing, oppressive system has sold us on a lie that living this way is how you find happiness and well-being. Through accumulating wealth or their perception of wealth, and objectifying other human beings in order to accumulate that wealth is perfectly acceptable and moral.
There is a feeling when you have a lot of people angry at you on the internet. And I can't imagine with that particular way your brain works, how hard that must have been, because that's not how my brain works. Mm-hmm. And it's still, I know when like we're wired to evolutionarily like need each other,
yeah,
and need the acceptance of the tribe. And when you have hundreds or thousands of people, even if you don't know who they are, online, angry at you, hating you, your body is going like, hey, you don't survive in these conditions.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, that's right,
this doesn't work. And
then if you factor in attachment theory, the fact that like for various reasons the vast majority of us as human beings like didn't get all of our relational needs met in our first 10 months of life, and then you stack on what social media is doing to our brains on top of that, like there's a reason why people commit suicide when Twitter mobs come for them. Like,
yeah.
I don't think we really understand what we're doing to ourselves. And we think it's helpful. And we think it's maybe even sometimes we might think it's noble. And there are really intense consequences to what we're doing.
And it really is. And anybody with any following is going to have something at this point, usually. Like, there's going to be, I remember it was a big, like aha moment for me one time when I was reading a Pope tweet. This was years ago.
Like the Pope?
The Pope.
He tweets?
He did back then. Oh, I don't know if he still does.
That's cool.
It was a different Pope.
Different Pope. Cooler Pope. The youth Pope.
And and but it was like the most, it was the most like benign, like humans, we should take care of each other and love each other. There's just something like, no, how can you have a problem with this? And then I remember reading through the comments.
Oh yeah.
And it's just like, fuck you, Pope. You just like, just the meanest, like rancor, just pouring out at just the most harmless tweet. And just like,
I know.
People have bile inside of them.
Here's the thing about that, though.
Spill it out.
Those people aren't actually mad at the Pope. They're mad at their dad, and they just haven't gone to therapy, and they just don't know, and they've repressed their emotions. Well, here's the thing. They don't have to be, though, but that's a bummer because they were taught to hate themselves because they had some adverse experiences, or they live in a world that teaches them to hate themselves. Like, We don't have to. I've been using a lot of air quotes. This is not going to go well on a podcast, but we don't have to be this way to one another. But it's understandable that we are in certain moments when we get activated because, like, we've got a lot of trauma that, like, we don't think we have. And we've got a lot of effects of trauma that we don't know that we have. And then we have a lot of habits and behaviors and personality traits that we think are ours, but they were adaptive. And so when we're put in positions where, you know, or we see something online that like maybe should just rub us the wrong way and we can walk away. There's a reason why people like can't walk away. Did you ever see that time when some guy was like really coming for Sarah Silverman and she just like asked him, I'll find the documentation of this because she softened that whole interaction by asking him like a really, not like the joking or sarcastic version of who hurt you, but kind of like the legitimate, like, hey man, this seems like an escalation in response to just me existing as a person. They entered into this dialogue and she found out that he was like facing this super high stress situation that I think it was like a medical situation or medical bills or something like that. And she ended up like connecting with him and she paid for them for him. Hmm. And like that interaction, I'm like, that's what's going on behind all of these. There's pain. There's always pain behind all of these things. And this is why social media can't and isn't doing the thing that we want it to do, is because we turn people into products. And so we're like, oh, objects and products that I consume, they're not in pain. We forget that people are in pain. And so the things that people do are projections of their pain. And I'm not saying that every person needs to go around doing emotional labors for strangers on the internet. But what I am saying is having that perspective can be helpful, and us learning how to like deal with our pain and slowing down our reactivity to the Pope or Sarah Silverman or strangers, other strangers on the internet, can help us not do this thing that we are doing to each other. But again, I just don't know if that's something that can actually functionally be achieved online. I'd love to be wrong. I would really love to be wrong about that, like more than anything. I really would.
Hopefully most of you are following Jamie Lee Finch somewhere on social media by this point, but if you're not, maybe try her Instagram. I am Jamie Lee Finch, or you can find her on Twitter at Jamie Lee Finch. Okay, next up we've got William, Hillary, and I speaking with Dr. Robin Espinoza. This one gets a little spicy.
I don't think cancel culture is real, really.
Okay, let's start there.
We'll start there.
I think the phrase cancel culture, to me, feels like some new iteration of something that's probably always gone on in human history. You could call it scapegoating. Maybe you call it bullying. Maybe you call it those in power making decisions. I think cancel culture uniquely to me emerged as a phrase to talk about the digital phenomenon of people generally with no power or very little cultural power having conversations and discussing situations, things, and people in the digital space, and, you know, either rallying support or rallying condemnation towards, you know, a particular person, place, or thing, right? And so to me, the fascination with cancel culture that's different than any other form of human negation, so to speak, that humans do to one another, is the fact that it's coming from people that it traditionally has never come from. I believe watching the Black Twitter phenomenon was probably one of the wildest things I can say in my adult life that I've actually seen. Primarily being, up until relatively recently, about 10 years ago, this country never really gave platform to the thoughts, the emotions, the opinions of Black youth, particularly Black millennials. No one cared what we thought. And then when Black people started driving conversation on Twitter, started making jokes and memes, and started speaking and weighing into cultural issues through this medium known as Twitter, it became an actual phenomenon where, in fact, you know, TV shows were exploding in the ratings because of Black Twitter, i.e. Scandal, right? That was one of the first TV shows that really benefited from that phenomenon and that effect. Black people would get on Twitter every night or Tuesday nights or whatever and talk about the latest episode of Scandal with Kerry Washington and how much they loved it or whatever. And it became such a cultural phenomenon that people, mainstream culture, white people in general, white America, started paying attention. And then things like the shooting of Trayvon Martin happened with George Zimmerman, the Ferguson riots. I think that's when everything really began to shift, was because a lot of the social media outlets were tuning down through the algorithms, the Black Lives Matter movement as it was first getting off the ground. Twitter did the opposite. They let the Black Lives Matter movement run the algorithms. And so part of the reason why we even have the phrase in our national consciousness now, and it's mainstream, Black Lives Matter, is because it was a hashtag that Black people created on Twitter about police brutality. And Twitter as a institution actually supported it, whereas Facebook turned it down. Like, you would go on Facebook and you'd see nothing about Black Lives Matter. If you turned on Twitter, you see everything. And so when Black people started becoming vocal on the internet, I feel like that's when this phrase cancel culture started emerging, because various folks were doing certain campaigns aimed at people they viewed as predatory, i.e. mute R. Kelly, hashtag mute R. Kelly. That's an example, I think, when people talk about modern cancel culture. And I would actually argue that that was a positive example, because here you had this grown man who had been sexually abusing girls for over 20 years and the legal system had done nothing about it. And it wasn't until Black women started organizing around a hashtag and showing up at concerts with signs saying mute R. Kelly and doing digital activism. And then the TV show Surviving R. Kelly came out. That's how all that got leverage. Then the police decide to do something. Then they decide to put him in jail. And so, to me, my frustration about a lot of the arguments around cancel culture and people like, I think it's a bad thing, or the negative perceptions of it, to me, are really rooted in, well, who has the power? Because very few people decry powerful people who cancel other people. You know, powerful people who sit in boardrooms, who sit in HR rooms, who sit in church boardrooms. You know, very few people decry those powerful people when they make like really damaging repercussions for all sorts of people. But when it's marginalized people who take their platform, their publishing platform through these social media apps and talk about the things they like, talk about the things they don't like, talk about the people they like, the people they don't like, and why they don't talk about them, then it becomes a national thing of, we've got to stop cancel culture. And so to me, a lot of this conversation around cancel culture is very gendered and very racist intrinsically, whether people realize it or not, because part of the reason we're coming to the conversation is because Black people finally got a voice in the mainstream conversation, and mostly white folks don't know what to do about that. And they're afraid. I didn't know I was going to do a monologue. Sorry about that.
And he sips his large lemonade.
I'm done. I'm done with this episode. Bye.
curious to hear your thoughts, Robin.
Well, cancel culture is something that I've spent a fair amount of time thinking about because I've seen people be canceled online, but I'm also holding the threat of harm that happens that produces the cancel. And how do we hold both the harm mm-hmm. and the cancel in tandem? I think that cancel culture is the same logic of silence that is used in supremacy culture. It's like when I was in Charlottesville that the white clergy wanted to take over the park, which is what the Nazis wanted to do. And I'm like, why are you using the same logic as white supremacists? I think cancel culture works in the same way. It's the same kind of logic that is being deployed that causes the harm. And so how do we actually reframe that dynamic in a way that reduces harm and that mitigates cancel?
Can you explain more what you mean by it being the what is the harm that you're speaking of? And also, how is it relatable to, as you said, white supremacy or the logic of white supremacy? Can you explain that more? Because I don't understand.
Well, I think that cancel culture is rooted in supremacy culture, period. Ooh. I think that it mimics the ways in which white supremacy works. It is often deployed against marginalized people, but it is the same logic as supremacy culture. Does that make sense?
No, because you keep saying it, but you're not explaining how.
So my example was in Charlottesville. That the white clergy wanted to take over the park that the neo-Nazis wanted to take. Why use the same logic as supremacists? How is that going to reduce harm and help bring transformation? Is that clear?
No, not really.
Tell me what's not clear.
Maybe I'm just not understanding your example or what you're using. I mean, when you say that, what instantly comes up for me is the very different ways that type of power is being used. You're trying to, I guess, make an argument about similar logic, but obviously, positionality and impact are very different coming from white supremacists versus, if we're pitting it against marginalized people, talking in the digital space or whatever. Again, part of this conversation is so hard for me because it all feels so nebulous in general. We all mean very different things around cancel culture. When I think of cancel culture, I'm primarily thinking about folks in the digital space using their platforms to express what their dissent around certain ideas, people, or products. And to me, I'm putting this, again, in the capitalist framework of, in our framework, folks have a right to decide what they will and won't support and to vocalize that. Like, our free speech gives us that right. Even to a level, many of these militias and supremacists have that same right to free speech. So unless we're just saying that the whole thing is just wrong in general, then, you see what I'm saying? Like, I don't even know where our starting place is on
this.
Well,
aren't rights-based arguments problematic in and of themselves?
Maybe not to people who haven't had them. I don't think they are inherently problematic on any level. You mean human rights, civil rights? I don't see those as problematic.
I mean, I think that there are some people who would say that basing an argument rooted in a rights-based analysis is inherently flawed logic.
Okay. I have no clue any of those arguments, or I've never heard any of those arguments, and maybe they are right. I think being contextual in space and time, in the place and space where I live, rights mean everything, and they matter. Mm-hmm. Because if I don't have them, then I have no form of protection against the supremacists who are coming.
But isn't that just capitulating to identity politics that are inherently flawed, that are based, rooted in white supremacy?
I don't think identity, there's not anything wrong with identity politics. That's probably my difference. I absolutely don't think there's anything wrong with it. I think everything is identity politics because we all function from the place of identity, whatever our identity is, whether it's white identity, whether it's Mexican, Latino identity, whether it's queer identity, whether it's woman identity, like whatever our, we function politically through our lens. And so I don't think there's anything wrong with folks saying that and folks coming from their perspective. I think what's wrong is when we use our identity to dismiss other people's identity completely. And I think the bigger conversation is how do our identities live in tandem and work together politically? I think that's a better conversation. But identity politics in and of itself, I don't think is bad. And I don't think, yeah. So I don't know where our starting place is.
I mean, I think identity is a social construction, and if our socially constructed reality is one of white power, then aren't all of our identities derivative of a particular power analysis or lack thereof?
Sure, I guess. Just, you know, listening to hearing you say that off the top of my head, I'm like, yeah, but again, it's my context. I can't escape it. I can't actually dismantle it either. To a major level, because it's what produced me, what we all have come from. So our best bet is how do we navigate these identities, right? Like, and yes, is it social construction? Sure. But I don't think that question is fomented in science around like identity issues, around like something is completely social, therefore there's no biological sense of any type of identity. I don't think science makes that point provable either. So from a deconstructionist lens, I think that's problematic, right? To say it's all social construction, so therefore it's bad. And I'm like, no, there is a biological work in tandem with the social constructions that are happening in our lives, the nature nurture thing. And so where those lines sit, I don't know either. I don't claim to know. Maybe Hillary can speak to that more so than I can in terms of like neuroscience and how does that relate to our identities? But again, I don't, yeah.
But see, now you use a term that feels technical. What do you mean by deconstruction?
Well, it's what you said sounded to me like a deconstructionist argument or a postmodern argument, right? That all these things are simply social constructions and that there isn't any type of, I mean, this is a very reductionist way of viewing it, but that's kind of what I was hearing. That your argument was that there is a social construction to identity, so therefore it's not inherently related to any tangible sense of like personhood or rooted in any biological sense of who we are, just something that we made up. That's what I was hearing.
Yeah.
And maybe that is what you were saying, and that's fine too. I just was saying, I just don't know if that's true.
Would it be okay to jump in here? Would that be okay?
Yeah.
I want to get back to something that you had said, Robin, earlier about cancel culture, but I don't want to take the two of you off course if there's something that's unfinished in the conversation here that needs to happen or needs to kind of like, if you're going somewhere, I don't want to interrupt that.
No, just
I don't think you're not interrupting.
Okay. One of the things I really liked about what you'd said, Robin, was that holding this thread of harm, but not perpetrating harm, in how we resolve the harm that was initially done. Is that what you were trying to say about not using oppressive systems to heal the wound that was created by oppressive systems?
Yeah.
Yeah. Could you say just a little bit more about that? Because I'm really curious about how you think we name that pain has happened without perpetrating more pain to resolve it.
Well, I think about, I'm very much into sort of cultural attachments and the ways in which harm is done within cultural attachments. So I think about a friend of mine who used to run the Irresistible podcast. And I think about the ways that there was a public, basically cancel culture, right, stepped in. There was a public cry for her to step down because she had perpetuated harm against a black woman. yes, the harm is there. Yes, she was using pillars of white supremacy to undergird the ways in which she created a working environment. That should all be addressed. But should she have stepped down? Like, the harm should be addressed, but should she have stepped down and the podcast go away? So how do we hold the harm with the fact that, I think my question is how do we restore our attachments? How do we repair them without producing more harm? Because with my friend stepping down from this podcast is a particular kind of harm culturally. Through now people don't have a podcast to listen to. Now there's disconnection. And so I feel curious about, are there mechanisms or are there strategies that can reformulate these dynamics so that it's not harm or perpetuating harm? Does that make sense?
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I also just got done with therapy, so I feel very therapized.
Okay. But what you're saying reminds me of Audre Lorde's famous quote about not being able to use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, and how when we are trying to name and make change in the elements of our culture that are problematic, we are still situated within that culture and have been infused by those tools that have created the harm. And it's like, sometimes I think about trying to crawl outside of your own skin. Like, how do we disentangle ourselves from these cultural tools and weapons that have been oppressive and do something different? Mm-hmm. And it seems like, I don't know, maybe we're in this cultural moment where we're grasping for new tools to ask, okay, given the harm that's been done and given the harmful ways that we have tried to address that existing harm, what can we do differently? What can we do instead? And I mean, I have all sorts of curiosities about that and thoughts from the therapy world about what it means to look inward and change and to look inward and to explore the way that we've been shaped and the harm that it's caused us to be within those cultures, within the culture that's hurt us. And then now we use to hurt other people. But I'm curious if you have a sense of an awareness of what those tools look like. How do we repair? How do we restore, without causing more harm? What could that look like? Have you seen that? How did it show up?
Well, I think a lot about what Paul Tillich said around the first act of love is to listen. Now, Paul Tillich is very problematic in other ways, but I think he's onto something, that love is a very intentional, specific act. It shows up in listening, and we actually don't know how to do that as a cultural body, as a body politic. And that if we were to chart new relational folds, I'm also writing about this a little bit, because I think that when we learn to have a relationship with self and other in embodied ways, we can reshape our democracy. And I think that one of those practices or one of the tools is actually in a particular kind of listening through empathy, certainly being trauma-informed. I mean, we are living with complex cultural trauma that right now we're all existing within a trauma bond. And so how do we actually reformulate that trauma bond to actually be a cultural attachment that will enable us to be healthy in our cultural attachment? Because in our trauma bond, we are just producing more harm and more harm. Yes, power systems are at play, but I think one of the tools that we're not utilizing is this tool of a particular kind of listening that is attuned to pain and suffering of the underside of those who are most impacted by multi-system oppressions, etc.
What does that listening look like? Like, how would that, do you have any thoughts? I would love to hear more about that. Like, what is listening in a public sphere look like?
I think it's a kind of non-reactive listening. I think that so many of us react instead of responding from our own grounded place of becoming. And I mean, I think that I've worked with a lot of white people, and white folks can't find their place right now. And I invite them to listen to the wounds of the world. And a lot of white folks don't know how to listen to the woundedness because they themselves are so wounded. And I'm not equating those two. Those are not parallel. They are not the same. But there is something to the fact that we all live with pain, and without being able to address our own internalized pain and the pain that we cause others, I think that we won't be able to be in relationship with folks. And I think this dynamic is what creates cancel culture.
Well, some of us don't want to be in relationship. And that's a big part of this too, because of so much harm that has already been done. So some of this is like, again, to me, I'm like, we're living in a capitalist system where folks are consumers, and they get to decide for themselves what they want to allow into their lives, what they want to believe, what kind of religion they want to worship, what kind of friends they're going to have, what kind of neighborhoods they're going to live in. We get to choose. And in a capitalist system, everything's being thrown at you. Even on social media, it's capitalism. Everyone's throwing their brands at you, their books at you, their products, their TV shows, their music, their whatever. And I think folks get to decide that they don't want it. And isn't that not part of this system as well, to say no? And actually, I get to say that loudly in dissent towards that. And I hear you when you're talking about the listening factor, but part of the problem is so much of this always still caters to the needs and the wants of white America, because we know who primarily has a lot of these problems. We know who is primarily causing a lot of these problems. That we're seeing in terms of oppressive situations and systems of power, and who built it and who benefits it. And so at some point, I think part of the pushback we're seeing that you guys seem to be calling cancel culture, which is to me just not even remotely what's happening. I think part of this pushback is marginalized folks saying enough is enough. You're not going to keep bullying me. I'm going to say how I feel. I'm going to tell you what I like and what I don't like and who I like and I don't like. And somehow it's like, well, now we got to listen. Now we got to actually be understanding. Now we've got to. And it's like, where was this understanding for 400 years? Where was this listening? Right? Like, and so still to me, so much of this, and I understand from a human to human relational value, if all things being equal, yes, let's listen to each other. Let's hear each other. Let's bear each other's burdens. Let's love each other. Let's always be nonviolent in our responses and non-reactive. But actually, we're living in such a violent system that sometimes it does call for those tools that people don't want to use. And I think of like my ancestors, who some of them, they didn't revolt nonviolently. You know, like Harriet Tubman walked around with a shotgun and freed the slaves. And if you got in her way, you were shot. Right. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Harriet Tubman with that gun. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Nat Turner and him reading the biblical text and choosing to do a violent revolution. Like that slave rebellion birthed my liberation too. So some of this non-reactive stuff and the non-violent stuff, I believe in it, but I also understand that there comes inflection moments and tipping moments where folks have got to break out. And again, I'm not justifying murder. I'm not justifying violence, because I really won't commit or do any of that stuff. And I don't even like when other people do it. But at some point, you keep your knee on somebody's neck and they're going to fight back. And to me, a lot of this cancel culture issue and this backlash or this conversation is still, to me, so rooted in not actually acknowledging any of the harm that brought people to the place where they remotely want to cancel somebody. Like, why are we even here? What brought us here? No one, everyone wants to talk about the people who are canceling. No one wants to talk about what brought us here.
Well, I don't think that nobody wants to talk about that. I was just in Portland and they're on day 96, I believe today, of in the town square talking about what brought us here. I don't think nobody's talking about this. I think it's actually quite loud in the culture of what brought us here. I didn't see any rallies about cancel culture. But I'm curious about parsing out what is, because, like, you know, mobs have been around forever. Mobs of people who are like, we're not okay with this, whatever the thing is, and we're going to take the matter into our own hands as a group of people. And certainly the only people that do that are not marginalized people. There's lots of, you know, remember Farewell Rob Bell? Remember this? There's lots of...
he just came out with a new book.
Oh, really?
It obviously didn't work, the cancel.
Everything is spiritual.
Cool. Yeah, so, but there's lots of people who band together to try to, like, get to shut somebody down in all different ways, not just online. And so I'm curious, like, yeah, what are we talking about with cancel culture when we're talking about it? That's not, are we just talking about mob culture or are we talking about something else?
I think so. I think you're right. Mobs have existed and they exist in every human culture. And I think there's a difference between folks who are collectively organizing versus mob culture and mob type behavior, right? Because people who collectively are organizing, which I think a lot of folks in the digital space, I think a majority of it isn't mobbish. I think it looks mobbish to some people, again, because of the lens and the framework that other people are coming from. But oftentimes what can look mobbish to you is actually people collectively organizing in a certain particular way, right?
What's the difference?
Well, the difference can be tactics, right? Certain things, like, for instance, culturally, there can be types of humor and joke. And we obviously see this in the difference between like what makes Black Twitter funny is the type of humor it employs and the type that it involves, which to some people looks disrespectful, that looks dehumanizing, that looks, depending on your cultural lens and context, you can look at certain jokes or types of humor and say that feels wrong to me or that's whatever. But to other people, they can see that very differently. So again, I do think there is difference. I think that the difference generally between mob and collective organizing is intentionality in terms of what the people are doing and also whether it's like rational or irrational. Because mob mentality is always irrational by nature. It's like the projecting of my sin on you, right? And you become the scapegoat to my unconscious, you know, sin that I don't want to deal with, or I make the Mexican the problem, you know, or they're stealing our jobs or whoever. That's very different from people who are collectively disrupting the system and doing it in absurd ways, or doing it using humor, or doing it using ways that make other people feel uncomfortable. I think
so. Maybe there are multiple ways that cancel culture is manifesting right now. Right. I mean, that's kind of what I hear.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there are multiple ways it is manifesting. And I think that's why I think the label doesn't work as a whole, as an overarching label on this phenomenon that's happening. I just don't think it works because every situation is so varied and the intent of every situation can be very, very varied depending on who's employing it and for what reason and why. And I think oftentimes, like I said, it doesn't make sense to folks outside. Like, you know, the TikTokers don't always make sense to me and what they're doing and why they're doing it, you know, and I can easily judge it and say, well, they're just this, right? They want to disrupt Donald Trump because they're just they've got that derangement syndrome, you know, like, and the things they're doing, and that, because that's what conservatives would say in a heartbeat. That's they would look at the K-poppers and say that on TikTok and say that's cancel culture. And we looked at it and was like, that is nonviolent resistance, you know. And so the way we're framing these things, I think, are really important, and that's why the vague generalizations don't matter. But how we use it, who uses it, who employs it, how it's being employed, I think is everything. And unless we're getting into real specifics, I just think what we'll end up doing with this podcast is lumping some people in with other people in people's minds. You know what I'm saying? Like, people will use this language and say, yeah, that's why the black people on Twitter are too much. Yeah, that's why the TikTokers are too much. And yeah, that's why the progressives on, you know, Twitter are just, they're wrong, and the queer folks over here, right? Like, I think it has to be clearly defined. Otherwise, we risk empowering maybe the mob too.
I just feel like part of what the reason that it keeps coming up, cancel culture, is because, or one of the reasons is, a lot of people are not willing to have really important conversations right now just to avoid the fear of any sort of mob. And there's a lot of lack of nuanced discourse. There's a lot of lack of the ability to really get into an idea and like what's actually true here and pull it apart and offer differing viewpoints. There's not room for differing viewpoints. There's not room to like grow in a lot of spaces.
But not everybody grows that way or wants to do that thing. And like certain cultures and certain groups of people don't value those types of both sides, like, you know, type of debate. And like, I think that's also part of it too, in terms of how people grow and learn, because not everyone grows and learns through those types of things. So I want you to continue. I wasn't trying to interrupt you in that way. I just wanted to point out, like,
is that true?
I don't know if that's the standard of like, this is how we all have to relate.
I don't know. Is that
not
true?
Everyone relates that way.
Can you learn a lot without having some sort of dissonance? I don't know that that's true. When I think about some of the harmful effects of cancel culture, you know, so-called cancel culture, I'm mostly concerned about the discourse in our society and about the ability to evolve together and make any meaningful change together if we can't communicate well, if we can't think well, and if we can't, it's hard to think well if we can't speak well with each other and learn and sharpen each other. And the fear that I know a lot of people have about, even a lot of people just avoid topics entirely that are really worth talking about because they're afraid it's too hot to talk about. And then how much is lost as a society because of that, and how many voices are shut down. I mean, the most extreme example that I can think of it is what happened in China years ago, when like at some point, if the intellectuals were actually shut down because it didn't fit the narrative, and like they took away the arts, they took away in extremes, when societies lose the ability to have counter discussions against the mainstream narrative, it ends very badly always. And so I am concerned about how can we all be able to use our voices? How can we all speak what we're experiencing and what our thoughts are in a way that doesn't silence or drown out anybody, but can we all somehow, is there a way to actually value communication and thought and dissonance as part of the human experience in a fundamental way, that we don't actually use the tools of the master but to shut down voices so that in the hope that it's going to help people's voices not be shut down? It's like, is it self-defeating? Is that, Dr. Robin, am I totally missing what you meant in some of the supremacy comments that you first made? Is that kind of at the, is that related in any way to what you were saying?
Yeah, I think it's related. And I think that, I mean, I like this term steward. How do we steward our pain? How do we compost it? How do we change it? And I think that, you know, your example of China, you know, if the intellectual doesn't fit the program, then they figure out a way to replace it. And I think similar things are happening in this country. Academics show up on certain websites if they challenge the system. And I really want to think about how do we develop an ecosystem, a cultural ecosystem that holds the pain but composts it into a better anthropology, for lack of a better term. You know, like, this is really about how do we be creaturely with one another in just and equitable ways. And I think it first starts with identifying pain and stewarding that pain into a different kind of reality.
In the digital space, I think we just have to be honest. We are living, at least in America, I think maybe the West to a level, is living in a global information war. Like, we're living through a culture war. And the digital space is a primary space in which that war is being played out, right? Like, and that's why we see the weaponization of identity. We see the language being used so strongly and forcefully and even in violent ways. And I think about every day I have to wake up and navigate using the digital space and being in the digital space, knowing, seeing what's coming at me on a constant barrage of misinformation, disinformation from foreign sources, alongside fascist propaganda from the White House. Like, so many people just feel on the defensive, because it's like, to remotely like open up the heart space to let difference in means letting in poison.
Right.
And if I have to choose between being a little more defensive and closed off and a little fuck you, you know, then actually opening myself up to the difference, but actually knowing that difference is tainted in the ecosystem, in the digital ecosystem, in our cultural ecosystem, because there is an intentional war going on. And so some of this to me is like, we're talking like peaceful people in the middle of a war. And part of that to me feels beautiful and revolutionary, right? And then the other part of me is like, yeah, but you guys do know there's a war, right? Like, to some level, like, I have to pick up my arms and fight, because if I don't, I'll be plowed over. And it feels that do or die for a lot of us because of the bombardment of Black Death that just comes at us so heavily. So as you were talking about that, I'm fully on board with that and languaging it in those ways, because I think those ways are a lot more helpful. Because to me, the term cancel culture really originates from the people that are trying to weaponize against us and against marginalized people, as a way to label, you know, marginalized people or Black people as being problematic. And so I just say I apologize if I came across really strong early on and like my, like, you know, when we were talking, because I just, for me, it's like, it is defensive and it is always a war for me out there, in terms of what messaging I'm receiving and what I'm like even allowing in terms of how we talk around certain things. And so I just want to apologize to you if I came across too strong, and that was not my intention. My intention really is to stand up for people who don't have a voice, including myself, and learning to use my voice in ways that are powerful, but also not intentionally using my voice in ways that are harmful. So, and I don't think I did, but if I did, I really, please tell me, and so I can apologize for that. But Totally hear you on that and respect what you said.
I love a strong presence. I love a good attack. I even love a good fight. I was taught to go head to head in the classroom and take down people's arguments. And William, I love it that you came across strong. And what I experienced, what I felt, was your pain. And if we can come together and hold each other's pain with a fierce tenderness, maybe we can compost it into something other so that we can build a better world.
I agree. Thank you. Thank you for holding space for me.
If you'd like to follow more of Dr. Robin's work, you can find them at iRobin, R-O-B-Y-N, iRobin. And that's the handle for both Instagram and Twitter for them. Next, we have the conversation with Dr. Hillary McBride, myself, and Chloe Valdery, who you can also follow on Twitter, which is a good follow. I recommend it. At C. Valdery, V-A-L-D-A-R-Y. And be sure to check out her other work, too. She does this thing called The Theory of Enchantment that's amazing. So, Chloe Valdery, hope you enjoy this conversation. Okay, maybe I can start us off with a question.
Yeah.
In critiquing or thinking about cancel culture, are we trying to cancel culture? If so...
Are going for the low extension? Hanging
fruit. Very nice. Very
Are we
nice.
Just an extension of cancel culture.
Very good.
Well, by definition, for us to thoughtfully engage with the construct, we aren't canceling it. We're moving towards it.
There you go.
We're interacting. We're getting curious. We're exploring the underlying motivations instead of thrusting it out into the abyss. So, my answer initially is no. You, Chloe?
I mean, I love anything that starts out with a very meta perspective. So,
well, welcome to What Is Your Podcast?
thank you for that. Thank you for that. No, I mean, I think that by merely asking the question, we're not engaging in cancellation. Hmm. And I think that I could probably think of some of certain elements of cancel culture that are reasonable and healthy in certain contexts. But perhaps the question is, should we just expand our toolkit to include more than simply canceling people when people engage in bad behavior?
Do tell.
Yeah, I want to know more about that. The toolkit. That's the toolkit.
I mean, you know, when I think of cancel culture, I think of how it's kind of antithetical to the spirit of restorative justice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've done a ton of work here in Brooklyn with volunteering at an organization that mentors kids whose parents are incarcerated. So I've been in conversations around, you know, that center criminal justice reform. And the work that I do is very much, I think, also centered on rehabilitation and understanding that a lot of bad behavior stems from insecurity and a mismatch of trying to meet one's needs with really poor judgment. And so all of those things influence, like, the extent to which I think cancel culture is not simply, like, immoral, but also just inefficient to tackle a lot of the issues that we're trying to tackle when it comes to bettering the human condition. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the podcast Ear Hustle, which takes place in San Quentin prison. Mm-hmm. It's a very beautiful podcast. It's very, it humanizes many of the folks at that prison. And it's really affected my thought process on criminal justice reform. But it's also the total antithesis of cancel culture, because, you know, a lot of these men who are interviewed have done really heinous things in their past, and yet you see that they also have a capacity for change, for self-reflection, for growth. And I'm not sure the extent to which cancel culture gives people that space or allows that space to develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm feeling so much resonance with what you're saying as a therapist. Mm-hmm. I sit across from people who are coming to see me sometimes because they know that there's something that's not working in their life, but also because often there are other people who are saying, your behavior is problematic, you need to go deal with that. Mm-hmm. So they come into a space where we're talking about their problematic behavior, these things that maybe, depending on the cultural context we grew up in, we even call sinful or problematic morally or spiritually. And it becomes pretty clear when sitting across from someone and hearing their story, in addition to understanding developmental neuroscience, that most of the things that we label as problematic are a person just trying to survive, just trying to meet the needs of their personhood or to belong in a community to escape the pain that they have based on the problematic behavior that other people perpetrated against them. Mm-hmm. And when we label something as sinful, or when we cancel someone or a behavior, and maybe that's a distinction we can talk about, canceling a person versus canceling a behavior, but we miss the fact that this is actually on some level a very typical response to being treated a certain way or being in certain social contexts, that that to do something different might be outside a person's means. So when I think about cancel culture, I think about missing the most important question, which is, what are the circumstances under which this behavior was allowed to occur and flourish, and how is it helping the person in some way? And we miss the opportunity to explore what function this behavior has and invite a person to reflect on healing in such a way that they could do something different than what they were already doing. And unfortunately, shame, which I think is at the heart of cancel culture, doesn't actually encourage people and communities to flourish. It causes even further fragmentation. And where is a person going to go put their pain then? It's going to go somewhere else. So I'm relieved to hear you say that too. And I think, I mean, Chloe, I'd love to hear more about when you make that distinction about when it's helpful, when it's not helpful, because that nuance seems to be missing in our public discourse right now.
Yes. And I'm not sure, you know, I've learned the specific times, you know, 100% when it is helpful and when it is not helpful. I know that there have been studies in Canada, I believe, and also in certain states here in America that have shown that an approach that's grounded in restorative justice leads to lower recidivism rates in certain contexts. It also tends to satisfy both the offender and the victim in terms of feeling a sense of fairness and a sense of justice actually occurred, much more than the more punitive system that is pervasive. At the same time, we haven't seen an approach to restorative justice sort of like scaled, I think. And so it would be and applied in all kinds of different, or applied to all correcting all kinds of different criminal behavior. So I don't think we have the data yet to say conclusively that restorative justice is the way to go. But I think from an interpersonal lens, and this affects a lot of the work that I do, especially when it comes to like combating racism. And I resonate a lot with what you just said about like a lot of the negative activity that people engage in that end up negatively impacting other human beings are in fact the product of scarcity and are in fact the product of insecurity. And because we live in such a snapshot generation, especially with social media, we see things through the lens of snapshots. We see things as though they are frozen in time. Like, for example, I know former neo-Nazis, right? If someone commits a heinous, someone assaults someone out of racism, or racist impulses. We see that, but we don't see what has happened to that person prior to that action has been completed. We don't see that person. We don't know anything about that person's upbringing. We don't know anything about that person's environment. We don't know that this person was in a broken home. We don't care to think about this person as a person in the first place, because now that this person has engaged in this heinous behavior, he is now forever a monster in our eyes. And monsters are mythical, foreign, mystical creatures that have nothing to do with us. And so we sort of separate them and put them into boxes instead of trying to do the much harder, longer, deeper work of understanding this person as a complete person and asking what was the environment that led to this behavior. And that isn't to, you know, that isn't to excuse a person of bad behavior or take away the autonomy, but without understanding it, we won't be able to create the conditions in a society that makes that behavior less likely. And I think that that is what we're really trying to do ultimately.
So how does that scale to, how does it filter down to how I use my social media account?
that's a great question. I think that if you would have met me 5 years ago, you would have met a person who was definitely like punitively minded on social media and who acted in such a way on social media. And quite frankly, I think it's important that we remember that social media platforms are set up, I was just tweeting about this today, ironically, are set up to trigger dopamine rushes. And it doesn't necessarily, it certainly does not often give us those dopamine rushes by rewarding good behavior. It actually rewards very aggressive, punitive or punitive-like behavior on social media. And so I think it's important that we each individually be aware of that, be aware of the fact that the algorithms are set up in such a way to reward that, and then make conscious decisions not to behave in that way. And to make conscious decisions to respond to people in our interactions on social media with grace. And that has to be a deliberate decision on the part of each of us, you know. And I think that we can actually, you know, I could be hopelessly naive, but I think that we could actually end up transforming the algorithm. I think we forget all too often, or we make the mistake of thinking that, like, we have no power because these systems seem all powerful. But ultimately, I personally believe that, like, the human being is the most powerful being on planet Earth. And so I think that we can, if we are deliberate and conscious about how we use social media in a much more gracious, magnanimous, redemptive way, then we could change the way we think about some of these other systems that we interact with in the real world.
What happened in those 5 years?
Oof.
Like when you say, like, what, 5 years
how
ago,
much
like,
time do you have?
Yeah, give us the story.
How did you experience transformation yourself? Because I think that that's really at the heart of what we're talking about here, is how do we change, but also how do we help other people change if they're engaging in something problematic? Like, what does it mean to transform ourselves and be transformed and transform other people as we interact in the world? So tell me about your transformation.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in a very interesting in a religious sense, home. I grew up in a Christian home that observed Jewish rituals. So I grew up observing not Christmas and Easter, but Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And I also grew up not only not observing Christmas and Easter, but on Christmas and Easter, our family tradition was to gather in the living room and discuss the etymology, the origin stories of these various traditions that had become sort of, I think, through the process of syncretism, adopted into Christianity. We fancied ourselves to be these, I guess, not puritanical in that sense, but like the original, like the OG Christians, you know.
Like purists. or something.
Yeah. And so I relished that tradition. I took great pride in this very particular manifestation of religion. So that was my upbringing. And then if you fast forward to college, senior year in college, I took a class called Anthropology of Religion, which totally floored me because I was going into it with certain presuppositions and certain assumptions about what this teacher would think and how she would purport herself. And this professor, this woman who taught the class, was agnostic. She identified as agnostic. And so I immediately prejudged her. I was like, ugh, this person doesn't understand, doesn't get it. So she had us watch various documentaries. One documentary she had us watch was about evangelical Christians. I forgot where. Oh, I think it was Jesus Camp. Mm. Evangelical Christians who, I mean, I think if you watch that doc, doesn't really paint this particular group in a positive light per se, putting it mildly. And so the very next day, I'll never forget this. The very next day, there was another student in the class who was an atheist who had done the homework of watching this. And she just started going off on this particular community. Mm. And then my agnostic professor speaks and she's like, you totally missed the point. You're missing the point of this class. You don't understand. Like, you totally missed the point. You need to understand, like, the desires and the fears and the traumas and the inner wants and needs of this community to understand why they have made the decisions that they have made. And you can disagree with those decisions, but if you don't understand and if you don't honor them as human beings, then you've totally missed the point of this class. And that totally messed me up, that her response, because I had put her into this box of, you are agnostic, so you are other, you can't possibly understand, I don't know, the religious mind or whatever. And here's this person who didn't quite fit into my understanding of godliness, who were defending people who were religious. And so that totally, like... that totally caused an existential crisis, quite frankly. Mm. I love quoting Brené Brown because she puts it as a breakdown / spiritual awakening. Right. So it's both of those things. And that class really challenged me. And then another inflection point happened in 2016 when I went to Rome and was totally blown away, in particular by the works of Bernini. I was sort of taken aback by the wonder of it all. It was so beautiful. That was the first, like, 3 days. And then the remaining 2 days, what really hit me was antiquity. Antiquity is staring down at you. And I immediately, now I think of the Stoic teaching to meditate on your mortality as a practice, as a healthy practice that you should incorporate into your life. But going to Rome and seeing antiquity in the present was such a morbid experience for me. And that depressed me because it was like seeing eternity before you and eternity after you and yourself as a speck of dust, which again was I think in retrospect was a very necessary experience, but at the time was incredibly depressing. But these two things, I think, led me to do some soul searching and to really try to rethink my belief systems, rethink my value systems, rethink, you know, my immediate assumption and need to prejudge people whose experiences I didn't know anything about. And those two experiences are two things that stand out as really being fundamentally transformative in terms of, like, the paradigms that I use to, that I see the world through naturally and intuitively now.
I mean, that experience of art and antiquity and mortality feels so humanizing and like something, something that invites us all when we have those experiences into a more rich and meaningful existence.
Yeah.
But there's something about that, what the professor modeled for you in terms of a critical perspective that invited this other student and by proxy you into a deeper understanding of what makes a human that generates curiosity and compassion feels like some ticket I wish we could give.
Oh God.
Give it's all of us.
Humanity, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's something about when you see people. We see the worst of this stuff a lot of times on social media because they're so removed from you being able to fully see this person. Like, you don't see humanity. You see Jamie was talking a little bit about how people become products on these platforms. And so you see a product and you're judging your product. You're losing your Amazon review basically for a shitty product that you bought. But that's a person. Like, there's a, and the more that you see a person, I like sci-fi, and there's the book, The Speaker for the Dead, part of the Enders series that I enjoyed. But what it's part of the story is, like, he would really tell the truth about these beings that had died. And it was never, like, pretty to tell, you'd go to these funerals and tell the full truth about somebody. There's always, like, parts of it that everyone's like, oh God, it's painful to really witness the fullness of someone's humanity. Cause there is brokenness and there is ugly bits. But the more that you see and how that is related to how they were raised, what their environment was, how they were bullied as a kid, what they're like, all those things, the fuller picture you have of this person's experience and memories and traumas, it just makes it so much harder to be shitty to them. Like, by the end of The Speaker for the Dead thing, they would tell all these truths that were horrifying, but then everyone falls in love with this person.
Yeah.
Because how can you not fall in love the more, if you fully see the humanity of somebody? I don't think you can but love them on some level. That's not to conflate their behavior
with
their humanity. There's obviously problematic bad behaviors, but I love hearing how your story, it's like the more that you saw of the universe, the more that you saw of what it means to be human, even yourself. I love that you tied that to how you treated other people. It's not just seeing somebody else's history and whatever, that's part of it, but it's also like the more that you see how magnificent and intertwined all of this is, you can't simplify and characterize somebody into just being one small sliver of something, of a product or something to consume. They just, the more that you see, the more divine and full of glory and wonder they become.
In conversation about cancel culture, it's so, I feel drawn to think about what we're trying to do with cancel culture, what we're trying to do being perhaps like communicate about problematic behavior and stop harm from being done and help a person or a system change. But in this conversation, I find myself continuing to come back to, why do we go to that as people? So if we're asking the question of why does a person do what they do, then I also want to ask the same of us, the people who are so quick to move into canceling. What are the conditions under which that makes sense? And what are the conditions under which we feel drawn to create this this boycott as a means of creating change, and where we learned that that would be acceptable or successful? So I'm curious, even in using theory of enchantment, Chloe, if you have a way of understanding why we feel so drawn to do that, to create change.
Yeah, it's a large question. It's a fantastic question. I think it probably has a little bit to do with how we are wired neurobiologically. I mean, we have to remember that, you know, as we evolved, we were constantly dealing with the threat of death. And I think we evolve certain tools to deal with that that aren't necessarily needed to the same extent that they used to be needed when we were trying to just survive as a species. So I think that that has a little bit to do with it. I also think that, you know, it's hard to overcome tradition. I think it's ironic that people often in the same breath promote cancel culture in the name of justice and then also promote restorative justice or criminal justice reform. I think that's very striking to me to observe that. But I think that we do that. We are used to the punitive system. Like, the punitive system has been with us for a very long time. And,
wow,
you know, I think that's true universally. That's not even just a Western thing. I think that this is something that we as human beings have been struggling with for a very long time. So I don't think it's going to be a short process to transcend it and to transform it into a much more holistic space. There's also this issue of ego, which I'm fascinated by, that I think plays a role here. Because if our identities are so attached to our egos, and I'm not one of those people who think that we need to completely like sublimate or destroy our egos. I think that I believe in synthesis. I think that, you know, I'm a very spiritual person. I think that all elements of the human being are divine or were divinely developed, including the ego. So I think that there's a place for the ego. But when we as human beings have to change, it's hard for our ego to get on board with that because we're so attached to the way we were and the way we are and the way we do things. And it's a kind of death that has to take place in order for a human being to change. And that's incredibly and tremendously, and it should not be understated, scary yeah. for a person to do that. So I think those are some of the barriers, challenges to transforming some of the systems that we're discussing.
Michael, looks like you just teed up there.
I was the congregating church going, yeah! Must have been trying to get in some words. Yeah, I mean, you were... I just love everything you're saying, Chloe. I'm curious how we can avoid some of the pitfalls of being unconscious about what's actually happening in me. Like, if I'm offended at something and that's really about my own insecurities, it's really about my own self-doubts and self-hatred and whatever, and I'm unconscious about that, and then I project it out to that person who offended me on the internet. Now I think I'm doing righteous work by calling them out. The difference of that and how can we be actively engaged consciously in a way. So I just heard the other day I pushed, I told Siri, I was like, "Hey Siri, play comedy." I was just in the mood to listen to some comedy. And the very first line, and to give you some context, I have a little daughter who has Down syndrome, who's 6 years old. And the first line that Siri gives me of comedy is like, "So retards these days are like," and it just starts talking about, it's like retard jokes. And I'm like,
yeah,
it's 2020. This is still, wow.
Yeah.
This is the first thing that comes up on my feed. And I can like notice that. And personally, because I'm, you know, there would have been a day that I probably would have felt differently, responded differently. I actually felt more sad for the guy. Like, wow. What a...
Yeah. Because he can't see.
He can't see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What a small world he's living in.
Yeah.
That he must be so full of suffering. It's not affecting me. Hmm. It's not affecting Lucy, my daughter. It's not like it's just a guy that's kind of an asshole that probably lives a pretty small life. So there's that aspect of it where I can, and I just kind of walked away from it. I didn't go on and tweet about this guy and try to. But what is? Should I be engaged? Like, not should. I don't like shoulds. But is there a way? How does someone who is conscious about what's happening that can have some degree of like awareness that I'm not actually offended at anything anybody else is ever doing? I mean, if I'm offended, that's something that's happening in me. But also, how can I be engaged in culture in a way that if somebody with Down syndrome was sitting in that audience, how can we make a better environment so that we don't have people so caustically, like talking about other people and hurting other people? How can you engage in dialogue in restorative ways of like, hey, this would be a more helpful way of talking in the world without resorting to the unconscious mechanisms that a lot of people characterize cancel culture as?
So I think the first thing that came to my mind when you were telling me this story was, you know, you don't necessarily, I mean, you don't, not even necessarily, you don't have to engage with this person on social media or anything like that, but you can write about your experiences. You know, you can express, you can, I think you can find a way to express your experiences in a way that is impactful and far reaching, but still loving and graceful and contributing to the creation of change. And perhaps we've been deluded into thinking, myself included, and myself especially, into thinking that like the only legitimate or the only primary forms of expression, you know, that we communicate to the world through should be social media. Now, I understand that social media, you know, is an amplification process, really. It amplifies things. It makes, it allows, for example, artists to be discovered even when perhaps prior to a social media platform that their art wouldn't have been as far reaching. I think that social media has done many valuable things. I don't want to, you know, totally diss social media 100%. But at the same time, sometimes I ask myself, am I spending most of my creative time tweeting, or am I spending most of my creative time making music? And, you know, should I be doing one more than the other? And still using social media to, like, you know, share the music, share whatever I create. But I say all that to say, number one, you don't have to engage with the person personally, but you can create, and especially in a particular, I think this is important, works of art that express your experiences and that communicate precisely what it is you're trying to communicate. That's number one. Number two, you should study the civil rights movement. Like, you should study the civil rights movement. Everyone should study the civil rights movement. But because what that was... I still don't think people understand how profound that was. Like, on a level, on a lot of those individuals were on a totally different spiritual frequency than how we live our lives. Like, completely different spiritual frequency. And they talked about this. They wrote about it, you know. But yeah, that's that. I cannot highly recommend it more than anything else, I'd say. You know, Michael, you said something. We both had a moment where we realized that the comedian on stage who was making those jokes couldn't see. Like, he wasn't fully awake to, I would call it, like, the wonder of life. And that's a totally different response and a totally different perspective of this human being than what I would have had of this human being, like, 5 years ago or even 2 years ago. And so... by refining the self, by working on the self, by really trying to develop that serious relationship with the self, one's filters through which one sees the world totally begins to become transformed. So I would agree with that.
I think I'm most likely going to just let that have been a moment and be like, wow, that was wild. But if I were impelled to act in some way that I've, you know, to culturally use that as a way of bringing about some sort of good, the way I see it, I loved how you brought it to art and to the civil rights movement, but, and like, what do I have in my hands? And the fact is, I have enough in my hands that I could probably stir up trouble for that guy, right? Like, I've got access to a couple podcasts. I've got followers on different social media. I could probably get some other people who are activists and people that are like, we could really like give this guy a shit show on Twitter. I don't think that's going to help that guy see better.
Right.
If I was going to engage my, what I have, I would rather like make a video with Lucy mm-hmm. and like, hey, I wanted to introduce you to my daughter, Lucy. I heard you making jokes about people with special needs. I just want to share a little bit about her life with you. Like, I've yeah. like, how can you, you know what I mean? Like, that might be more effective well, to actually change how yeah, he I feels.
Think, I think that would be 100 times more powerful. But like, yeah, I think that if you were to do, if you were to take the former route, and this is the other thing that goes into, I think, what inspires cancel culture within human beings. We feel empowered when we see mm-hmm. someone performing badly and we get to, you know, put the gauntlet down and say, I now, you know, in the literal sense and in the metaphorical sense, pass judgment. That's a very empowering thing to do. But it's not necessarily the action that's going to bring about change. And so this requires us to ask what it is that we actually want. And why is it that I need to do this in this way to feel empowered internally? Why is it that there isn't some internal, eternal sense of power that I feel naturally just being human and being alive? Mm-hmm. Like, why is it that I have to do this to feel empowered? So yeah, I mean, and I also happen to think that the artistic expression of your life that you just described would actually be more powerful and impactful in the true sense of the word.
You're asking questions that invite us to reflect on ourselves when what we typically do is see the other person as problematic. We make them an mm-hmm. object that's problematic and we respond in past judgment, but we miss the entire experience that happens inside of us, that there is a transaction going on where we are giving ourselves power and feeling power in that yeah. moment. Mm-hmm. And so when I think about this from a clinical perspective, what I'm hearing you say is we need to slow mm-hmm. down. We need to take responsibility. We need to know ourselves. We need to understand what we are trying to get yeah. in that encounter
yeah.
and practice regulating that, perhaps what feels like an impulsive response to grab power and pass judgment in a way that actually fractures us further from ourselves and inhibits the formation of a community yeah. that is built on mutuality, power sharing, and I would say compassion. Wonder
yeah.
is the word you've yeah. been using.
Wonder. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite words.
It's so good. It's the best. It's the best.
And enchantment's a good word,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's a good word.
Yeah. Yeah, you did good. I know it's my bias talking. Like, I can't remove myself in this instant from my training and my worldview. But in the practice of psychology and understanding what it takes to develop a person, I don't know of any non-traumatic ways to immediately transform a person without it fragmenting them from themselves. I don't think that getting sacked with shame yeah. can actually be restorative. And I think what it does is it adds trauma to the existing wounding that created the problematic behavior in such a way that it actually compounds whatever pain was there. And where is that pain going to go if it was already expressing itself as dysfunction or pathology or hurt? How do we think that doing more of the thing that wounded the person in the first place would bring them into fullness? So I believe in the long game of relational work that yeah. changes a person by creating a felt sense of safety and curiosity under which the protections that we've developed can begin to fall away. The protections that hurt us and hurt each other. But that long relational work takes patience and takes this understanding that there is more going on than what feels good for me in that moment. And if I have power or if I don't have power, and that sense of managing responsibility that takes so much emotional regulation.
Yeah.
But we can't do that in a social context where we have the death penalty. Mm. I mean, as a Canadian, I don't have the death penalty in my country. Mm. But what we're saying is we are individuals who are responsible on social media for changing other people's behaviors. But we don't see how we exist and have developed in a social context where our government systems are using punishment to try to change people. Yeah. But that's also filtering down to how people parent. I mean, I don't want this to be shaming at all, but time out. Time out is this experience so many of us felt from early on, where if we did something that was non-compliant, we were sent away.
Ooh.
And we were told, yeah, you have to go away in order to change your behavior, without asking the question, why did that behavior emerge in the first place and what relational need was it trying to meet? So I don't think that if we have a society where time out is normalized, that we can expect things to be different on a broader social media scale. Well, that's exactly what we're trying to do to other people to change. You know, it was really, I would say, life-changing for me when we're thinking about the transformative moments, really life-changing for me to understand that everything we label as pathology has had a function. Everything we label as problematic socially, personally, we can even say things like addiction or violence or, right, a theft. I mean, all the way down to lying, or for me, you know, thinking about eating disorder stuff. And it's all had some sort of purpose. And when we understand it as having a purpose, we can understand the problem that it was trying to solve and see the thing underneath the thing in such a way that we can start to begin to dream up culture and relationships in ways that heal the wounds, the actual wounds, not just penalize the way we're trying to manage the wounds. And that made me feel more hopeful about humanity. Like, I don't like that we hurt ourselves and each other, but I think it's really cool to notice that with all of the pain that we have been dealt, that each of us carry in different ways, that some part of us was trying to take care of ourselves. And it just sucks that in trying to take care of ourselves, we hurt ourselves and other people. But I think that there's something there that can feel restorative too. Like, oh, there's a function. There's something at work here. And we can just come up with better solutions for that pain.
So the ability and the capacity to acknowledge that is crucial, mm-hmm. You know, but I think that we are so, we're so in a way self-conscious. We're so afraid to look at ourselves. It's easy to look at the other, but it's very hard to make sense of oneself. I think it's complicated.
I'm really excited about this next conversation with Peter Rollins, at Peter Rollins for his social media accounts. Pete always brings an amazing insight and clarity and precision to these conversations when we have him on. And this one is one of my favorites with him. I just think it brings such a powerful glimpse at how cancel culture, so-called cancel culture, is related to our own sense of self and our relationship to the world. We talk about ontology. I'm not going to spoil it. Let's dive in. All right, welcome back to the podcast, Peter Rollins.
Hey, it's always so lovely to be back in your backyard doing this.
Yeah, you're a crowd fave, and you're one of my faves, for
sure.
Oh,
shucks.
So we're doing an episode on cancel culture, and this is actually like the fourth conversation. They're doing that kind of a mega episode.
We're putting right. Together. I thought the other ones had been canceled. No, they
But in all the conversations we've had so far, I've been...
like I knew that doing this conversation, it was like murky waters for me. I'm a little biased. I've faced some angry internet people more than a couple times. And so I've been kind of like kind of listening and like, what's really going on when we're talking about cancel culture? And so far in the conversations, I mean, we've gone to place, we've talked about how to like, you know, be more positive in our social presence and online and some of the difficulties that happen when we commodify humans and cancel them as though they're just things.
Yeah.
When we think in black and white terms of good and bad. But I still think there's something unexplored. And I really wanted to talk to you about this topic to see where we would go philosophically with this.
Oh, great.
But I'm wondering, because the feeling that we've been talking about cancel culture and what's underneath that, there's been a feeling that kind of reminds me of what it was like in Christian school, being that rigid feeling of like knowing that you're on the good guy's side, that feeling of, and it would spill out into silly ways, like when we learned in Christian school about the different theories of creationism. These were all acceptable ways, quote unquote acceptable ways of believing. You could believe in the gap theory of creationism. You could believe in the literal 7-day. You could believe in like the day age theory of creationism. There's different ways of reading
it.
But it was all still based on some sort of biblical literalism. But even within that
some of those are right and some of them are very wrong. The gap theory, my goodness, if you were a gap theory person, get out. Just leave right now.
The fuck out. Yeah, so it was technically, but there was like a rigidness still. And it just makes me wonder, is what we're calling cancel culture and what we're experiencing as cancel culture really just like a level of human development that has finally become writ large in a way with social media and the internet of not being able to handle dissonance?
Yes. Yeah. It just amplifies what's already there. Yeah. Which is kind of what you would imagine, is it can't really create a new human thing, but what it can do is can amplify something of our basic subjectivity.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is from a philosophical, because when you texted me the other day, I was like, oh, wow, this is a nice hot topic. Yeah. And I thought, okay, right, what do I think's going on? And
sorry, I can hear the air.
Ah, right, okay, yeah, that happens. But look at that, even you pros get that. See, when I do the fundamentalists, the air conditioner is always a problem.
Yeah.
I think the way I think about it is that we have a wonky ontology. So I would love to talk about that for a bit.
Please.
And so for your listeners, you know, an ontology is a theory of being. And so when you talk about ontology in philosophy, you're talking about the nature of a thing. And so one of the basic ontologies that we see today, that's actually our whole socioeconomic system is based on this, is a notion that we are individuals who enter into the social world. So at a very basic level, you think of yourself, you enter into the world, you're born, and then the family socializes you into the world. So it's almost like you're on the side of a swimming pool, and then you jump into the swimming pool with everybody else, right? So you start with an individual, you enter into the public arena. And this leads us to see ourselves as separate from the social world. So it leads us to what can be called have the look. And a look is where you look at something and you see yourself as separate from it. So either you love something or you hate something, or you're just neutrally looking at something. But whatever you're looking at, you are not entangled in. Mm. You're separate from. Now, this is a wonky ontology, I would argue, right? And a better ontology is the idea that actually we start as in the social world, and individuality comes later. It actually arises out of our social environment, which means we're not individual monads who engage in the world. We are already entangled in the world that we navigate. So if you look at, you know, even economists like Milton Friedman or people like Ayn Rand, they all are assuming that we are individuals, private individuals, entering into the world and engaging with it. So if you take this other view that actually we start off as social beings and our idea of individuality comes later, usually around 3 months old, and actually goes when we're old, when we're in our 80s and 90s, begins to dissipate again. You take that idea.
Or when you take mushrooms or whatever.
Oh, yes. Well, yeah, absolutely. MDMA, that kind of stuff. Well, definitely.
Or meditate a lot or whatever the thing
is. I would love to talk about that, actually. And that will come up in this, I think. Is if you take the idea, yeah, that you are entangled. In psychoanalysis, this is called the gaze, right? So the look is when you are perceiving the visual field like a neutral observer, like you're almost outside the world looking in. The gaze is a very complicated idea in philosophy, but basically it means that the gaze is the moment that you realize you're enmeshed in what you're looking at. And I'll give you one example. I've got loads of examples, but I know somebody who attacks a lot of conservative religious people online. So he's always attacking these people. But then through talking to him and working things through, it turns out, so he comes from a conservative religious place. And although he sees himself as looking at that world, right? I'm looking at that world. Yeah. It's a toxic world and I want to get rid of it. What he discovered is the gaze, which is what he realized, that his desire is enmeshed in the scene that he is looking at. And so he realized that what he's doing is he's fighting a part of himself. There's something of him in the scene. And in psychoanalysis, this is very key, that we have to realize, we have to experience the what's called the trauma of the gaze, which is we have to realize how our desire is enmeshed in the things that we hate and love and even just look at. I'll go one more example. This is a friend of mine who, she when she was young, she was always separated from her family. She stayed with family members. Her father was always traveling. So she was always experiencing this separation and reunion. And also with the school she went to, she had that experience. Now, fast forward 30 years, and she finds herself in relationships with people who are distant in various ways. And she's like, oh my goodness, why do I fall into relationships that have distance in them? And also her work involves a type of distance. And through analysis, she realized that it wasn't just neutrally that this was happening to her. There was something of her that was in that experience. Something in her was connected with it. And so she thought she was just looking at this. This was just happening to her. But actually, she's entangled in the scene that feels like it's separate. And that's what I think cancel culture arises from, a wonky ontology of, I am not enmeshed in what I'm attacking. Whereas actually, we're always immersed in what we love and hate.
Yeah, I love it so much. I've been reading this book and doing the practices of this book called Existential Kink.
Oh, I haven't heard of it. Sounds good. It's a good title.
A good title, right? And it sounds very familiar, similar to that. It's like looking at what bothers you. What are patterns in your life that you think you hate?
Yeah.
And then like the practice is looking at the underside of that and unconsciously, what sort of pleasure are you getting from that?
Yes.
You're getting something. Like you think you hate that feeling of fear, whatever, but it's an arousal. There's a physical arousal that's happening. There's something in your body that's getting a thrill. There's something in your unconscious.
Yes.
That's seeking something.
Yes.
And so like the practice is going into that and actually allowing yourself to feel the thrill of it. So yes. if you look at your anger online at that person, what do you get out of that? What are you getting out of your anger? And that's the ego's like, no, look away.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, like I actually get to feel good, like pretty righteous when I get to be really angry at that asshole. Because I know better. I used to be there and I know.
Yes.
And I know better. And so like, you're projecting this, your own process, your own unconscious shit, onto that person and trying to distance it from yourself.
100%. And that it's a type of, I like to call it existential entanglement, because funnily enough, in the world of physics, they talk about quantum entanglement. And it's a similar thing that in existentialism, there's this notion that we're not subjects. We think of the world as subject and object. I'm a subject. The world is an object. And what, interestingly, at one extreme, you know, if you go to a Berkeleyan idealism, you can say, well, everything is subject. Right. Or if you go to a crude materialism on the other side, everything is just atoms bouncing and I am observing the materiality of the world. But in this notion of existential entanglement, it's that, yes, there is a subject. Of course, I feel myself as an I, and there is stuff objectively out there, but I am entangled. There is this moment, the gaze of where subject and object are intertwined. And if I don't see that, what I do is I distance myself. I think of myself apart from. And this is the root of fascism. And not everybody who does this is not a fascist in it directly. But within fascism, there is always a denial of the gaze, which is the distortion that you don't like, the toxicity that you don't like is external and can be removed. Whereas this notion of the gaze is you can never get rid of the toxicity of the other because it's the toxicity of yourself.
Oh my God. I love it. Yeah. We don't cancel. You don't see big, usually on Twitter, you don't see like big threads about everyone canceling the man that murdered his family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cause that evil is so, I probably haven't dealt with that.
Yes. Yeah.
I probably am not like repressing that and projecting that in myself. So I see that. Nobody's like, canceling hyena culture.
distant
enough.
Yeah. And there's like let's say there's 10,000 equally legitimate issues that are in society. We don't engage with them equally. The ones that we pick tell us about ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's very funny when you see people trying to pretend to care about an issue because they want to avoid hypocrisy. And you can always tell the difference between someone who cares about an issue and then going like, oh, but it's somebody from this other culture who did that. So I have to pretend to be annoyed at that. You know, there's all of this stuff. But realistically, we realize that what you love and hate and what you observe, you are inside it. You're within it. You're entangled within it. And once you notice that, the reason why in psychoanalysis that's so important is because once you realize that, you change your position with regards to it. So you suddenly are like, oh, that's a part of, I'm not trying to cancel them, I'm trying to cancel myself, right? So cancel culture is generally a person is trying to cancel a part of themselves through canceling another.
Yeah.
And so they're going like, what is the part of myself that I'm not looking at, that I'm what's called projecting onto the other or interjecting from the other. What is it? You start to look at it and then you can start to have this much more positive and much more beneficial dialogue with both yourself and often with the other person. So it actually changes the whole dynamic.
Wow.
Yeah,
it is so... I mean, progressive Christian Twitter is... It's such a... The people that are mad at the evangelicals. And I used to be more in that camp. Yeah. I used to get a lot more mad.
And I totally understand, because there's always a trauma to the gaze. This is what Lacan would say, is that they're like, it's always traumatic to see your own desire interwoven into what you are attacking or loving. It's like, you don't want to be confronted with that. So it's so much of society is about a disavowal of the gaze. So it's the look, not the gaze. The look is I'm divorced from what I see, because we do want to, we all feel the trauma of the gaze when you go, oh my goodness, I'm not fighting you. I'm fighting myself. Oh my goodness. I'm fighting my parents. I'm fighting my relationship with my siblings. Oh.
So what's in your psychoanalytic or philosophical leanings or preferences, what do you do or have any recommendations for when that's noticed? It's like when the shadow comes to the light and you go, oh, that's me. That's my own aversion to the faith that I grew up with, aspects of it, because I felt foolish, or I feel like it makes me feel righteous. What then?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, and this is incredible, is sometimes if you create a community where you attempt to help people experience the gaze, and by the way, one of the ways of doing that is a community in which one of the only rules is that we stick together no matter how much we hate each other. That's kind of one of those, you know, within reason, right? But if you've got a community, you kind of go like, sometimes you're going to really annoy me, I'm going to really annoy you, but we'll try as much as possible to stay in the same room. And a community which attempts to help you experience the gaze. In group psychoanalysis, they do this. So for example, a friend of mine, he runs a group, and they've got very few rules, right? There's a group of them that come together, but the rules are made by the community. And there's like, I think there's really two rules. One is, you know, don't eat or drink. Don't come in with a can of Coke and drink while someone's talking. And the other is, I think, don't come in late and don't walk out on anybody. So these basic rules. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is the rules aren't there to be kept. They're there for analysis. So one person comes in and they're drinking Coke. And then you go, oh, you know, why is it you would do that? You know, so the group asks, why would you do that? And then, you know, you discover that there's something maybe they're annoyed about in the group. And this is their unconscious way of protesting. Now, they don't even realize it. They think, oh, I was just eating a sandwich and thought I'd finish it in the group. But then you discover, oh, actually, no, I'm saying something, you know.
Yeah.
So a community that experiences the gaze, the thing I was going to say is that sometimes you don't have to do anything. Literally, when you're confronted with how your desire is interwoven with what you're attacking, that can be enough to change your entire way of interacting. Sometimes it often takes more, but sometimes you don't even have to do anything. Like that's the first and last step.
Yeah.
Yeah. The insight is the action.
Right. I mean, that's like the Jung quote, the Carl Jung quote of, until the unconscious is made conscious, it controls your life and you call it fate.
That's exactly
it. So as soon as you see it,
yes. That's why in analysis and in depth psychology, it's a talking cure. It's like literally bringing something to the light. There's a beautiful verse in the Bible that says, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it's not talking about 2 + 2 = 4. It's talking about the idea that we always hide our truth. We always want to repress the truth, hide ourselves from ourselves. But simply knowing the truth is itself what will set you free. Coming to know. So we're always trying to cancel ourselves, we're always trying to censor ourselves, but when we're able to know the truth of our desire, that very act is itself freedom.
Alan Watts talks about, like, if you are pinching yourself and you want the pain to stop, it is this, the moment you notice it's you pinching yourself, it stops. You don't have to take further steps. You're like, how does this pinching ever stop?
Yes.
Like, oh, it's me.
Yeah,
that's I'm it. Pinching myself.
Like, imagine, here's my vision, right? Is that, well, so we are in systems that we think we're separate from. So we socioeconomic systems, political systems, communal systems that we think we're observing, that we think that if, whether we existed or not, they would continue. And to a certain extent, that's right, because there's millions of people involved in them. However, this idea of the gaze is the notion that actually these systems exist insofar as we believe in them. And you not participating, you becoming what I call it, like having a different logic of desire, having a different mode of being, right? That in itself isn't just you stepping out of the system. That's you actually changing the system. Mm-hmm. Because the system is requiring, you're like a battery, like in the Matrix, plugged into the system, giving it your libidinal energy. You unplugging yourself from that mode of desire through this acknowledgement actually is, in a very small way, sapping power from that system. And so my vision is for communities that are able to detach, who are able to experience the gaze. If you have enough of those communities across the world, you don't have to do anything. That is a doing. That is a radical political intervention. Mm. That is a rupture. That's an apocalyptic moment. So, yeah. But you need a lot of communities. So I've got an idea for how to do that.
All right, let's hear.
Well, this is the core of, right, is that it's very hard to set up new communities, right? But what if there was already a network of communities that met around the world, hundreds of them, millions of them, let's say. And let's say they all met once a week, some of them twice, some of them three times a week. And let's say that people went to them all their life, even brought their kids to them and were married there and died there. And then what if those communities had an emancipatory message that's, yes, being covered over, and yes, is kind of like being a bit messed up. But what if you could just kind of bring out that emancipatory message in those communities? Then you already have the network set up.
Mm.
So my work is to try to find,
be a Christian.
Yeah, is to find if there is such a thing as a massive network of communities meeting every week.
That's amazing.
And then re-narrate them in this way.
Yeah.
whether it'll work or not.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's like, what if you could have them having said the words of this emancipatory message, but they just need a little like lens click to.
Yeah. Just go. And you know what? The word reformation is that lens click. Yeah. That's funny. Like, I think that basically the lens click is these institutions often, they go through, and a reformation's weird because nothing changes, but everything changes. So nothing, like the same language mm-hmm. is used, the same structures, and yet everything is reinterpreted in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
And so a lot of my work as religion has tended to be...
Or a completely upside down way.
Yeah, exactly. Or Mark said about Hegel, that Hegel was on his head, so he wanted to turn back on his feet. So yeah, that's the plan. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I love... And then that happened for Jesus for me, but it had to happen through like Eastern religions.
Yes.
And like Ram Dass and... All of a sudden, they were talking about Jesus, and I was like, "Oh boy!"
Yeah,
I'd kind of like just walked away from it.
Yeah, yeah. You find a really interesting, because there is that really interesting link that people like Alan Watts and others have done, which is to kind of like bring East and West together in a really interesting, mm-hmm. in a really interesting way. Yeah,
but yeah, Jesus would say, "You're not hearing me. You're like, this is seeds. I'm scattering seed, and some of it's landing on different. And you don't understand what I'm saying."
Yeah,
and we were like. Yeah, they don't understand what he's saying.
Yeah. Like there is a way of reading Christianity that's not about belief even in God or anything like that, but that actually, you know, you're potentially, it is bearing witness to, whether he exists or not, bearing witness to some event of encountering the gaze. So for example, Jesus was, you'd very hard push to make a belief out of what he said. He said different things to different mm-hmm. people, told parables, all of that. But there was this weird sense in which he seemed to confront people with themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what he was a master at. He was this. Now in psychoanalysis, they systematize this, but is how do I confront myself? And I can't do it on my own because everything about me is defended against it. My consciousness is defended against it. I think that I love my mum when I dream about her, something terrible happening to her, or whatever. So maybe I don't love her. Maybe I'm angry mm-hmm. with her, or I'm angry with a friend, but I don't even know it. Like, I am in such self-deception.
Mm.
And so what we need is our places in our lives. I call them deserts in the oasis, quiet places where we are confronted with ourselves. And that confrontation is always a trauma. So the traumatic confrontation with yourself, but that traumatic confrontation with yourself is enough to transform you and bring healing or the cure or salvation or whatever. And I do think that there's a way of reading Christianity that is about engendering a traumatic encounter with yourself.
Hmm. Okay, so how does all of this move down into practicalities as far as, so obviously if you're offended, you want to join a mob of sorts.
Yeah.
Or you want to really just give it to somebody online in their comment section or whatever.
Yeah.
There's obviously like, you can recognize what's going on and how this is really about yourself. If there's a kernel of pain, if there's a kernel of really strong emotion, good clue, like, probably about you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what about from the other side? Like, what about, does this impact people who get hurt online? Not just have been canceled, but like when people say things to you.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's a great point. I mean, and actually being a public figure today, I think it's very dangerous for people to be a public figure if they don't know how their desire is enmeshed in the public world. So when you're attacked, it can be painful if you don't realize that, you know, there is a certain projection that's happening. It can be painful. And mm-hmm. so, like, if that's what you're talking about, yeah, there's partly you know, I bear in mind that I bring myself into the public world and I'm enmeshed in the public world and other people are doing that. And sometimes I have to listen to critique and go, right, okay, what's good in that? How can that kind of improve who I am? But also, you know, what's going on here that is within them that they're working yeah. with. And those are interesting things. Like my big thing is, and I'll see what you think about this, but is that the toxicity of the other is always a threat to us. So we our common sense thing is that the other is someone who I either want to convert, right? There's basically four things, right? I either want to make them into me, so consume them, conversion. You've got a weird belief or practice. I want to bring you into my social body, consume you, make you part of my social body. If I can't do that, I want to spit you out. Mm-hmm. I want to kind of avoid you at all costs. You can be over there in that country and do your weird stuff. Or the third is tolerance, where we can operate in the same space, but just keep your weirdness, your toxicity to yourself, those weird beliefs you have. And then the fourth, which is very common, is, well, beneath all our differences, we're all the same, right? Beneath all the separate rivers, there is an ocean that we all pull from. Now, I don't like any of these, right? I think they're all awful, right? Terrible. The fourth one especially, right? It's the worst of all. It's the last ditch attempt at avoiding the toxicity of the other, because the first three, I'm right and you're wrong, and the fourth, we're both right, let's have tea and biscuits. But the truly traumatic thing about the other is not that they're other to me, it's that they expose my otherness to myself. So when I see myself through your eyes, and you come from some different culture, and I see myself through your eyes, at first you're the weirdo, but then I see myself through your eyes and I'm like, no, I'm weird. I'm a weirdo. Like, my beliefs and practices and my culture are a little bit strange, and that's terrifying. So I'm more terrified at encountering my own toxicity than yours. So I want to get rid of you at all costs. So what I want to do is go, like, how do we create communities where we actually enjoy what's the alterity or the otherness of the other? We enjoy the kind of difference that we are to ourselves and to others. Like, we enjoy that back and forth. Because if we don't find a healthy way of saying it, there's a guy, Kevin, who said this to me the other day in this class I was doing. And he said, like, if we don't find a healthy way to disagree, we will find profoundly unhealthy ways. Because we kind of need the back and forth. Because we're social creatures, I would argue that we need the obstacle of the other. We need the tension, that this iron, you know, as iron sharpens iron, there are sparks. We need the sparks. But if we avoid the sparks, if we try to surround ourselves by people who think like us, see the world like us, we only read books that we agree with, what will happen is not that we will, you know, kind of become more isolated, it's that we'll have more outbursts. We'll find unhealthy ways to generate the tension that we haven't found healthy ways. So take a Hollywood star who's got everything, so there's no tension in her life, and she's caught shoplifting in Target. You're going, why is she shoplifting in Target? Well, because if you haven't got healthy forms of tension in your life, you're going to find unhealthy ways to bring the tension back. So I think a lot of cancel culture, here's my theory, is that a lot of cancel culture is encouraged or amplified in communities of the same. The more you have a community that values an ideological purity, so mm-hmm. purity cultures, the more you will find cancel culture, which is mm-hmm. kind of against common sense, because you all kind of almost think that the more you look for the same, you let the other go. But, well, maybe it's not against common sense, but yes, the more you have a purity culture, I would say the more you'll have cancel culture. And that's what you said at the beginning with creationism. The more you want to purify the view, the more angry you get at anyone who disagrees slightly with you.
And in some ways, a person in my context who would have actually believed in gap theory probably would have been seen as weirder than somebody who, like, was just a full evolutionist or, like,
100%.
Some other tribe that has a myth about Gungor, Gungor. It's funny.
That's right. I mean, Freud called it the narcissism of small differences. Actually, it's the closer the difference, the more it explodes. Yeah.
Which was what you, isn't that part of the whole, like, Yeah, eating your own.
Yes. So the people who get most damaged by cancel culture are ironically the ones who are most invested in it. If you look at people who are not libidinally invested in cancel culture, they rarely get damaged as much. They can either, it washes off them or whatever, but the ones who are quite libidinally invested in it often end up being a victim of the very thing that they themselves were part of. So this is why I really like, there's a philosopher called Immanuel Levinas, Jewish thinker, and he, most of his work is based on the idea of the other, the importance of what he calls alterity, that we need to, and he actually says that the face of the other says, do not murder me. This is a beautiful phrase where he says, every time you look at a face, it's saying something, even if it doesn't speak. And what it's saying is, do not murder me. Mm. Do not abuse me. Do not objectify me. Do not reduce me to some sort of like mere thing in the world. And Levinas, in fact, Levinas is a beautiful definition of atheism and theism. A very Jewish kind of notion, because it's nothing to do with belief in a God. He says the theist is one who opens themselves up to hear that cry and to respond to that cry. And the atheist is the one who closes themselves to that cry. And now he doesn't mean, and also he doesn't believe in God or whatever. He says, no. If you hear the cry of the other and you feel yourself entangled with that cry, then you are exhibiting the heart of the Jewish faith, that the heart of the Jewish notion of a relationship with Yahweh. And if you don't, even no matter what you believe, you can say, I believe in God and I do this, and you can have all your right beliefs, but if you're closed off to that cry in the face of the other, whoever that other is, then there's something that you're cutting yourself off from the ground of being, basically. It's quite a nice kind of interesting approach. I'm not very Levinasian, but I do like how his approach is the opposite of a lot of today, where we want to surround ourselves with the same. He's always going, no. The real grist of life, the real enjoyment of life, is when you encounter the other, and the other in the other, and the other in yourself.
Part of that's beautiful, and part of it, I'm like, I mean, that's not how an atheist, I'm sure, would like be described.
Yes. And I totally, absolutely, when I say that, I feel exactly the same. But when you hear it, when you realize that Levinas is like, he's a Jewish philosopher, but not a theist himself, or I don't think, doesn't believe in some sort of, you know, I don't think, ultimate kind of being or anything. What he's kind of going is, it's similar to Paul Tillich, actually, where Paul Tillich says that, he calls it the God beyond God. Paul Tillich says, and it's not about belief in a being. He says that religion is ultimately attempting to ground you in a experience of ultimate concern, is what he says. But it kind of gets weird because suddenly the definitions change. But this happens also in psychoanalysis. In psychoanalysis, when people talk about the masculine and feminine, for example, they don't mean male or female. Or when they talk about the mother, they don't. Like, it's funny when you see these academic disciplines use words, but in really weird technical ways that don't fit with how we use them in everyday life. Yeah. So that was a good point to make, is like, if someone's here and I go like, you know, I'm an atheist and I don't interpret it. But a theist would be just as annoyed. You go like, hey, you're saying I'm not a theist and I believe in God. Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah, as I think about, I mean, kind of backtracking a little bit to the... how to bring this, how to embody this sort of awareness of how our ontology and how our projecting and all of it affects our interactions with each other and the way we see each other, the way we engage with trying to change things in the world. It can get layered, and the more you practice it, the more you practice becoming conscious, and you find like ways of looking at what's really going on, whether through therapy or whether through mindfulness or, you know, whatever the spiritual practices or that you're engaged in to like bring things to the light. It does. There can be layers. 'Cause I was thinking, as someone who's, like I said, also at the beginning made people angry on more than one occasion online, I can look, it does help me on some level to be able to know this. When they're mad, it's really about them. There's one aspect. that that's true. And that kind of softens the blow. There's kind of a like, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Kind of thing. But there's also, if you stop there, I think.
Yeah, if you stop there, it's not good. Because there's right. also something of you that's in it. Like exactly. you're both enmeshed. So yeah, you can't say, Father, forgive them, because, you know, we're not Jesus. we're not pure. So it's working out that.
Yeah. So it's also like, what am I getting by consistently pissing off people on the internet?
Yeah. Yeah.
What kind of thrill am I getting?
Yeah.
And you don't have to moralize it. This is what I love about the existential kink thing. It's like, there's no need to think that that's bad.
Yeah.
I'm getting a kick out of pissing people off. And there's no reason to think it's bad that you're projecting your shit onto somebody else.
Yeah.
There's not an inherent morality to that, I don't think.
It's mostly, from a philosophical angle, first and foremost, it's just trying to understand how the ontology is. So it's how to understand how it works. So, yeah, when people get into the morality too quick, you realize, no, we're just trying to work out why is it that we are enmeshed? What's the mechanism? So yeah, this is partly just understanding. We're all part of this. We're all guilty of it, and it's not something to be guilty of. It's just the way it is, you know.
Yeah, and then when you see it, I mean, I think the power of it, and have been experiencing the effects of this, is when you see the shadow side of it, and you embrace it as part of yourself, and there's like a healing in that way that thing that you've tried to be like, that part of yourself that you've tried to pull away and put over there to distance from yourself has been integrated and accepted. You're free, because now you can see, oh, okay, I want to feel, if I want to feel self-righteous, and I think that I can, will that feeling that I'm seeking actually be best experienced by shitting on somebody on Facebook? Is that really what's gonna like get me feeling like I'm okay?
Yeah,
like that I'm acceptable and worthy and loved. Is that really the best avenue to get what I'm looking for?
Yeah,
and most of the time, no, it's not gonna be, the more you see it, but not because you've moralized it, not because you've made a rule, don't do that.
Yeah.
I'm bad if I do that. It's just like, there's actually more effective ways of getting what you want.
Yeah. And when you experience that, so to do a concrete example, right, say I'm attacking someone who has, really views that I really don't like about some kind of moral issue for me, right? And so I'm attacking him, and I genuinely also believe that they've got a view of the world that's not good, right? But I'm attacking them, and then I realize, oh, like, I'm kind of attacking them, but I'm attacking my parents, because my parents used to think like that, and I used to think like that. And actually, maybe I'm taking out kind of my frustrations, my repressed frustrations on this person, right? So I suddenly get the experience, the trauma of the gaze. What that means is not that I no longer kind of say anything to this person, but what I might do, for argument's sake, is I might go, listen, I'm sorry. I realize that, you know, these are issues that I have in my family, and I'm still working this stuff through, and I think I was, you know, taking it on you a bit. Now, the other person, that is going to lead them to be much more likely to go, oh, well, listen, I totally understand. It's fine. You know, sometimes these things get out of hand, and we all get a bit angry, hot under the collar on social media, right? It gives them the invitation to do that. And then I can say to them, yeah, and, you know, the truth is, like, I still think this isn't a good way of thinking, and I kind of really want to work this stuff through. Then the other person goes, well, yeah, you know, I might not be right. And suddenly the whole kind of tenor of the conversation has changed. And although that won't happen every time, you would not believe how much it happens. It almost seems like a caricature, like, oh, that would never happen. But actually, we all know that if we get into arguments with our partner, and we very soon we're all arguing like we're world experts, and as soon as one person says, listen, I'm sorry, like, I don't really know what I'm talking about, I got a bit carried away there, the other person is less likely to go, yes, I won,
right.
Yeah, screw you. They're more likely to go, oh yeah, no, and I'm the same. And then a productive conversation can happen. Mm-hmm. So even from a strategic point of view, this notion of you shall know the truth of the gaze and that truth will set you free, is, it's not just personally useful. It's actually strategically the way in which progress occurs.
Mm.
Yeah. So there you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
Cancel culture solved.
What's that?
Cancel culture solved.
Yes, that's right. We have canceled cancel culture. I have a friend, he's a psychoanalyst, and actually he said to me, as a psychoanalyst, it's funny because we're all censors and we all are cancel culture people. And he says, when I work with people in the clinic, he says, they're all canceling some part of themselves. They're mm-hmm. all censoring parts of themselves. And that is then, you know, obviously being expressed in their lives. And he says, and my job is to, you know, help them see what they're canceling in themselves and what they're fighting. And that, you know, ultimately leads to a healthier person and also a person with healthier relationships and ultimately then a better citizen. Mm. So, yeah.
Well, I'm happy that my instincts were that Pete needs to talk about this.
Oh, I was really pleased when I saw your text, man. Thank you for inviting me along.
This is exactly the part of the conversation that I feel like we needed. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you everybody for listening to this episode of the Liturgist Podcast. If you'd like to join the community of people who are talking about this stuff, you are not alone. Go to theliturgists.com. We have a thing every Sunday called the Sunday Thing, where we talk on Zoom about the topic of this week's show and then all kinds of other stuff. We've got meditations and the other podcasts, weekly podcasts, and all sorts of fun goodies for the community. So please do join us and be a part of this beautiful community of people. I'd love to thank all of our guests and our hosts. Thanks to Tejas Lehrheiden for his help with editing the show. All the love to all of you. Thanks.